From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on March 29th during an MSNBC town hall to discuss the Green New Deal. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and former Republican Congressman Bob Inglis were debating the issue, with Inglis suggesting that the Green New Deal could alienate potential supporters of climate change policy. He said that the deal might be too ambitious to be achieved in a single Congress session. Instead, he suggested zeroing in on climate change now and then returning to other issues in the Green New Deal, like universal basic income, in the future. Some audience members expressed disappointment with that statement, with one person even shouting that he was a moron. And that's when Ocasio-Cortez jumped in and shouted that that remark was unacceptable. And later she tweeted, "Let's debate, not debase." The sentiment is shared by Inglis, who lost his job in 2010 in Congress after pushing back on Republican tenets on climate change. And since then, he has served as the executive director of RepublicEN, republicen.org, a group of conservatives, libertarians, and pragmatists who promote free enterprise solution to climate change. He shared his story with us on this program 3 years ago, and it will be instructive to hear from him what he sees as changing or perhaps what is not. Inglis will be in Rochester this week for a presentation sponsored by the Greater Rochester Chamber of Commerce and the Rochester Regional Group of the Sierra Club. We'll preview that forum this hour with Bob Inglis and our guests. We'll also discuss how much really has changed or not since the former congressman's last appearance on this program, and also how he engages with those, often from his own party or own ideology, on this issue, because there does seem to still be a political gap on the subject of climate change. I'd like to welcome our guest for the hour. Bob Inglis is on the line with us, and it's always nice to have you, Bob. Thanks for taking the time. How are you?
Great to be with you, Evan. Thanks so much.
Also with us in studio, Peter Debs is vice chair of the Rochester Regional Group of the Sierra Club. Peter, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also with us is Mark Cohen, chief of staff for the Greater Rochester Chamber of Commerce. Mark, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Also with us is Linda Isaacson-Fidelli, member of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition leadership team and the Rochester Regional Group of the Sierra Club. Welcome back to you.
Thanks, Evan.
And Jose Fernandez is here, president of the University of Rochester College Republicans. Jose, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, there's a lot of different directions to go, but real briefly, I do want to ask Peter Debs to tell us what's coming up on Wednesday, starting at 5 p.m. at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. Go ahead.
All right. Well, we have taken a big jump from our usual sort of environmental forum, which is often focused on specific environmental issues that are of concern to our area, to look at something in terms of why we're having difficulty coming to agreement and getting things done in a fashion that will really help prevent further climate change. And that means that we need to work across the border with, across the boundaries with other groups that don't align with us on all philosophical aspects. And so we have partnered with the Chamber of Commerce to specifically show there is a way to collaborate on issues of climate change and to reach agreement.
All right. And so if people want to participate, how can they do that?
So they may sign up online. There, if you go to the Chamber of Commerce website and click on events and scroll down, you will see the event listed there. And there's a place where you can register there. There's a suggested donation of $10, but no one will be turned away.
All right, so there's some information there. And Bob, I know that you have done this story so many times and you've done it on this program, but given that it's been a few years since we talked to you, I do think it would be instructive for you to offer our audience a little bit of your own background, including how you once considered yourself essentially a climate change skeptic. I mean, you're not a rhino, you're not a Republican in name only, you're not a Democrat in sheep's clothing here. Tell us a little bit of your story.
Well, it's great to be with you back in October of 16, Evan, and good to be with you again. This is, so as I was telling you back then, you know, for my first 6 years in Congress, I said that climate change was nonsense. I didn't know anything about it except that Al Gore was for it. Since I represented a very conservative district in South Carolina, that was the end of the inquiry. I admit that's fairly ignorant, but that's the way it was for my first 6 years in Congress. Then I was out 6 years doing commercial real estate law again in Greenville, South Carolina, running for Congress in 2004. And my son, the eldest of our five children, came to me and said, "Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment." It wasn't a threat. He was going to vote for me no matter what, right? It wouldn't have been in his economic interest to vote against me. But what he's really saying was, "Dad, you can be better than you were before. So how about be relevant to my future and my your four daughters' futures. So that was the first step of a three-step metamorphosis for me. Second step was going to Antarctica with the Science Committee and seeing the evidence in the ice core drillings. And third step was being inspired by the faith and the response of faith of an Australian climate scientist and wanting to be like him, loving God and loving people, caring about the people who are going to come after us. And so that prompted me to introduce the Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009. Probably not such a good idea in the midst of the Great Recession in one of the reddest districts in the reddest state of the nation. It didn't go very well for me in a Republican runoff. I got 29% of the vote after 12 years in Congress, and the other guy got 71% of the vote. So ever since then, I've been out proclaiming what for a while seemed a heresy. And now things are turning around, and Republicans are starting to see that, oh, this is completely consistent with conservative values and sits with the values of progressives as well. We can bring America together.
Well, Peter Debs, given Bob's kind of comments about finding these this common ground, you mentioned at the outset here, what's happening Wednesday, and frankly what's happening in this country, is not about only creating ideological purity. To solve this problem, you're going to have people who disagree come together in different ways. And you look at maybe the Sierra Club's founding as a way to kind of find some common ground?
Well, yes, I do, because the Sierra Club was founded to enjoy, explore, and nature. That's what, and also protect it. In fact, the Sierra Club was focused initially on preserving some of the great, beautiful places in the United States, so Americans can continue to enjoy them in the future without seeing the trees cut down and so forth. Well, that's been the mission for quite a long time, but as it became evident that climate change can severely affect everything on Earth, including huge impacts on nature, it has become then the number one issue that the Sierra Club is addressing. And with all the news that we've been seeing, it's pretty evident that we are not addressing the problem of climate change in a fashion that's fast enough to really avert disaster. And that the only way we're going to be able to do this is to be able to collaborate with people who disagree with us and on various other things. But that basically means Democrats and Republicans have to come together on this in order for us to achieve meaningful changes that will address the problem.
Linda Isaacson-Fidelli, how do you see the question of finding common ground, especially now with what you do with RPCC? Do you find yourself any more or less optimistic these days on that?
Oh, that's a tough question, Evan, because I work on this to keep my head down and my focus in one place so that I don't get into a non-optimistic place. But what I can say is, to support what Peter said, is yes, working together across the aisle is extremely important. And we think that the solution that Mr. Inglis is touting, a carbon fee, is something that both sides can agree on, because those progressives who want to address climate change know that both scientists and economists are saying that if we can only do one thing, that's the one thing that will make the biggest difference. And then, can I continue?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then locally, working with RPCC, who's intended, Rochester People's Climate Coalition, where our intended impact is to make the greater Rochester region carbon neutral by 2027, we know that we need to do that. The only way to do that is to influence decision makers locally, and that we need to work with decision makers on both sides of the aisle. So we need to establish relationships with them. And we also need to ensure that regular everyday citizens, our colleagues, are encouraging our decision makers to take action.
Carbon neutral by 2027, you say?
That is correct.
But define carbon neutral.
So that means reducing our emissions enough that anything else we do to sequester carbon cancels each other out. So we kind of recognize that we can't reduce emissions 100%. It would be difficult, but there are other things that we can do to reabsorb the emissions that we can't stop emitting.
Okay. So let me kind of continue around the table and ask Jose to tell us a little bit about perhaps what's going on this week. I know University of Rochester College Republicans have an event. Is that right, Jose?
Correct. So the day after Congressman Inglis gives his keynote, he's going to come to the University of Rochester. He's going to have a private lunch with the college Republicans, and then he's going to have a public panel discussion open not just to our students, but those from the Rochester community at the University of Rochester in Wegmans Hall, 1400, from 3:15 to 5 p.m. on April 18th.
Okay, and you know, I can't ask you to speak for all Republicans, nor can I ask you to speak for all the Republicans from your generation. I do want to ask you how you view climate change, and if, generally speaking, your fellow Republicans that you interact with, especially your age group, view it similarly.
Oh, boy. well, so I got introduced into politics because I really like the economics, and so the economics profession is pretty unanimous in this in supporting carbon taxes and other measures to counteract climate change. So I never really took the route that Congressman Inglis took, but I think most millennial Republicans tend to be in favor of similar measures. They tend to be you know, somewhat fiscally conservative, but a bit more socially liberal than most Republicans, and they tend not to be skeptical of climate change or other measures like that. And I would say most of the people who I've interacted with, at least, tend to be of a similar mindset. Now, on average, I'm not going to speculate as to what that's like after, you know,
sure,
Donald Trump, but, you know, most millennials tend to have a similar view, as I understand it.
Okay, that's fair enough. And again, he's speaking generally. Before I turn to Mark Cohen from the Greater Rochester Chamber of Commerce, former Congressman Inglis, do you generally agree with that? Do you see a difference sort of generationally about how conservatives, young conservatives, view climate change?
Yes, Jose is our hope. You know, there he is, a triple major and a minor, I think, in economics. And so, you know, it's just, it's smart policy. As Linda was saying, and Peter was indicating, there are real opportunities to work together. But it's, yeah, so we find that Jose is wonderfully typical among young conservatives. They plan on living on the planet a bit longer than their grandparents do. Their grandparents are, frankly, harder for us. Because I think, you know, a lot of cases they felt like they've seen a lot of change in their lives. They don't want to see any more. But people like Jose know that change is our friend on climate change. We have an opportunity here to create wealth and create jobs by cleaning up the air. And what an opportunity. And so, that's what we find among young conservatives. Hmm.
Mark Cohen, Chief of Staff for the Greater Rochester Chamber of Commerce, how do you view the Chamber's role and what's going on this week? Kind of give me your take on what the Chamber's up to here.
Sure. Well, Evan, thanks for making this a topic of discussion,
sure.
And I want to thank our partners on this event. It's going to be really exciting, and we're excited about it. I think regarding the political argument, which, you know, which Congressman Inglis is very well aware of, you know, you look at the United States history in terms of our presidents, and Teddy Roosevelt by far is the biggest environmentalist any of us know. I mean, 230 million acres of public lands that's protected the National Park Service, the Antiquities Act. You're talking about a Republican. And so I think that when looking, and I think this is precisely Congressman Inglis's position, but when looking at environmental sustainability and business development are not and ought not be mutually exclusive. And you see when TR was president and, you know, the turn of the 20th century was a time of massive expansion within the United States, business expansion and recognizing the role of business. And I was talking with Linda before this, just recognizing Rochester Chamber stands firmly in support of this sentiment because it's crucial that, you know, we recognize the role of business. Corporate social responsibility is something that Rochester Chamber is attempting to be and continuing to be a leader on, in recognizing our role in sustainable business practices, and that, you know, by engaging in sustainable business practices, we are not inhibiting business. You know, it's not in spite of that, but rather, you know, because we support business and want to see that sort of expansion, which is so necessary, particularly in upstate New York and particularly in Rochester in this region.
I want to turn to former Congressman Inglis with a soundbite that comes from a couple of Fridays ago on this program. We had Congressman Joe Morelli on the program. And Bob, you're not likely to know every member of Congress now, and he's a freshman member of Congress, a longtime majority leader in the New York State Assembly, and now he is a freshman Democrat in Congress. And we were talking about climate change and about the Green New Deal and about the call from, generally speaking, from scientists that, and we got 11, 12 years to kind of get to a place where carbon and fossil fuels are not dominating our energy grid, or we could have sort of irreparable long-term impacts from this. And so I asked him if he feels like, you know, we're on a road to doing that, that by 2030 we could essentially be fueling our cars in different ways and not rolling up to gas stations like we're used to now, that we could see real change on the grid in many, many different ways. And essentially he said, no. Let's listen.
I've seen no one lay out a plan to get there by 2030. And do I think that would be a worthwhile? If someone said you could if you spent $1 trillion over the next 10 years and you could have the answer to this, I would say, sign me up tomorrow. Let's do it. But I don't think you have the votes for it. And I don't think the technology is in a position where you could do that and deploy it that quickly.
So his answer is no. Congressman Riley thinks that not only is there not enough political will, but the technology can't get us there by 2030. So, Bob, do you share the view that we've really got to do it by 2030, and what would you say to the congressman then?
Yeah, we are in a big hurry to get this done. And I was saying that Jose is our hope, he is, but I can hear the scientists ringing in my ears say, Inglis, we can't count on demographic change. Man, get going faster than that. And so it is urgent that we get this done. But so what I'd say to Joe is this, in the mid-80s, McKinsey was asked by AT&T to tell AT&T how many cell phones would be in service at the year Y2K. McKinsey thought and thought and came up with the answer, 800,000. But the only problem is there were 800,000 cell phones going into service every 3 days as Y2K rolled around. So McKinsey had missed it by some number of orders of magnitude. And so that is what I think is going to happen on energy. And it's interesting, it's about the same time frame. So, you know, I just happened to see today, Gmail is 15 years old today. And I remember walking into my law firm in that time between my years in Congress and having a young person who's sort of an assistant tech person for the firm who's sitting at the front desk. And he was telling me, oh, you got to check out this thing called Google. And I said, what's that? And he said, a search engine. And I said, what's that? And so, I mean, now, of course I know what Google is. Of course I use Gmail. And so 15 years is all Gmail's been in existence. And so Tesla is worth more today than Ford Motor Company, even though they make a fraction of the number of cars that Ford makes. The reason is, the smart money is projecting forward and saying basically what Mark was just saying about the Rochester Chamber of Commerce position, that this is an exciting opportunity. And so what I'd say is, yeah, we've got to convince people who aren't yet convinced, but some of them will only be convinced when, like me, they tried out a little thing called Google and found out that, yes, indeed, it was a lot better than what I had been using as a search engine.
A lot can change in a short amount of time. I mean, I certainly agree with that. I have to say, Linda Isaacson-Fidelli, listening to Congressman Morelli, I don't want to give too much away, but you winced a couple of times there. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think it was regarding his assertion that we didn't have the technology. I mean, I really think we do. For us to say that we are the greatest nation on earth, and at the same time to say that we can't come up with or don't have the technology, I think is inconsistent. We absolutely have the technology. We've done it in the past, what with getting to the moon and mobilizing for World War II. So we know we can do that. It's really just the folks who say that we don't who are holding us back. We need the will. The resources are there. They may need to be pulled from something else, but that's the idea.
He did say he's trying to be realistic, Linda, that it's important to be realistic in what we can achieve and what we cannot achieve. And that he's open. He said there's not a single proposal out there that he is full on board with, whether it's carbon tax or fee and dividend. But he said that he's open to hearing more ideas. And it's an important time of dialogue.
So I guess I have to agree that there isn't a single thing that we can do to get where we need to be by 2030. And yes, I do agree that we need to be there by then. We need to do a whole host of things. But it's still true that scientists and economists alike say that if we only could do one thing, this carbon pricing idea is going to get us the furthest, the quickest. It's the biggest bang for the buck solution. So we think we should start there and then enlist additional solutions through legislation, regulation, business practices, whatever.
I know our other guests want to jump in. Peter Debs, go ahead.
Yeah, I also want to say I really bemoan any comments that sort of mitigate or just diminish the capabilities of human beings. And I think I could throw one thing out. Last weekend I was in New York City and I went to the American Museum of Natural History. And I'm looking at the recreations of how Earth was 300 million years ago. 200 million years, the creatures that lived, we know what they looked like, we know what they ate. How creative, how ingenious are people? I'd say don't ever put down the amazing creativity and ingenuity of human beings that, yes, we can come up with technology and the things we need to achieve this goal.
Okay. Mark Cohen?
I just want to add on and speaking, you know, from the business opportunity perspective of environmental sustainability and sustainable business practices, you know, we think of it as you know, good corporate social responsibility. We think of it as an opportunity for businesses to advertise themselves as pro-environment, as you know, and as a marketing tool or whatever it might be. But businesses can, should, and do think a little bit more selfishly in terms of their bottom line. And when you look at the opportunities that exist for businesses, it's not just in renewable energy, which is certainly a massive opportunity out there, but it's also with waste removal from the environment. It's also with, you know, the microplastics and the healthcare industry and all of these, you know, other sort of hot button topics that we hear day in and day out. And by the way, many of the folks who run these companies stand to benefit greatly. You know, and they identify as conservatives. They would identify as Republicans. And so recognizing, you know, opportunities out there for businesses, again, I have to plug our region in the Finger Lakes and the city of Rochester specifically and opportunities which exist right here in upstate New York. It's critical that we keep that in mind and don't just look at this as a political issue or as a divisive issue. Look at it as an economic issue. And the congressman has spoken, both Congressman Morelli and Congressman Inglis have spoken on this issue. And I think that it's important to realize that partnering with such organizations is a good way to improve a company's bottom line, many of whom are our members or prospective members.
Okay. Jose, you want to add to this?
Yeah, a few points. So the Congressman Morelli cited $1 trillion over 10 years. And I think one problem is that people just look at the budgetary expenditures. But from an economic perspective, I don't really care how much we spend. The question is whether or not on net it's beneficial. So in an $18 trillion economy where the federal budget is over $4 trillion a year, we can easily find the revenue and the expenditure. So the $1 trillion over 10 years, it really doesn't sound like much when you actually look into it. And second, there's this idea that often you either have to be pro-growth or pro-environment, and that those two goals are mutually exclusive, but that's just not the case. There's an economist, Michael Porter, at the Harvard Business School, and he came up with something called the Porter Hypothesis. And the weak version of the Porter Hypothesis is that stricter environmental regulations actually increase innovation. And the literature is fairly clear on that's the case. The stronger hypothesis is that it actually increases firm performance, but the literature is a bit murkier there. But still, the evidence is pretty clear that on net, environmental regulations are significantly welfare improving. So just lastly, there's not just one policy that solves everything, but it starts with pricing the externality, and that's why the carbon tax is so important. But you can complement that with a lot of other measures like congestion prices or payments for ecosystem services or a lot of so-called nudges in behavioral economics. And all of the evidence is very clear that at the margin, each of these things will significantly reduce emissions without reducing welfare.
Well, before we get some of our feedback from listeners on this, want to remind you that on Wednesday, starting at 5 o'clock at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center, former Congressman Bob Inglis is coming, Executive Director of Republican, and we've been telling you about the event there. You can still attend, and they would love to see you there. He's got multiple events here, but I want to turn back to Bob and at least say this, Bob. I mean, I take the point that what you're saying about what Congressman Morelli said is, you know, he's trying to be realistic. He's trying to say, political will is very difficult to muster for a lot of big issues, not the least of which is literally changing our energy grid by 2030. he's not seeing that at this point, nor is he seeing the technology. He's just trying to be realistic. Some might say, isn't that what Bob Inglis was doing when you were on MSNBC with Chris Hayes and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, when she brought up the Green New Deal and her idea to loop in a lot of things to the Green New Deal that some generally conservatives think are a little extraneous to climate. So, for example, a universal basic income, economic justice, etc. This is some of the interchange on MSNBC when you were responding to that view about what's realistic, what could get done, and why that should or shouldn't be in there.
But I worry that what we do is if we have basically the mirror image of a Trump rally on climate change, that we drive all the people away that could come our way and solve this thing now. And then could we come back to things like universal basic income? Could we come back to health care? Right. Because, you know, I was in two Congresses that were totally consumed by health care. You can't do it in a single Congress, the entire Green New Deal. It is literally impossible with the number of committee references that right. you would have in the course of that. So is it possible that we say, listen, climate change is the thing that we're seeing, the whites of its eyes, we've got to act now. Can we come back maybe to universal basic income a little bit later?
Hey, that's unacceptable. And that's the difference between me and Trump.
All right, so Bob, that exchange indicates where you think the realistic limits are of what Congress can achieve. Is this a case where you and Congressman Morelli just have different opinions on what the limits are that Congress can achieve on this?
Well, I think it's two things. One is, Congressman Morelli, what I would say is, you know, when I get discouraged, where I go to for encouragement and where all of us go at republicen.org is to the 17 minutes of pure American exceptionalism, JFK at Rice University, September of 62, the moonshot speech, where President Kennedy admits that some of the materials needed for the spacecraft hadn't been invented yet. No matter, we're going to the moon before the decade is out. I mean, that's the kind of optimism that Peter was just talking about, and it worked. So, I'd say I have a slightly different take on the exchange with AOC. Secondly, I think we want a bolder solution than what she's talking about, actually. One on climate, bolder. In other words, don't just focus on American action. Figure out a way to get to lead the whole world. And that's what, of course, Jose was just mentioning. If we can internalize those negative externalities here and then apply that carbon price that Linda was talking about at our borders, at our ports, get that through the World Trade Organization, which we think is possible, and then watch the whole world follow. So it's actually going beyond the Green New Deal. It's going to a place of saying, not just here, not just in America, but we intend to lead the world. Just like JFK said, we're going to win the race to the moon. We are behind. He admits in his speech, we're behind, and we know it. But we will make up, he says, and we will pull ahead. And so it's essential that America use the strength of our marketplace to do that. People want access to this marketplace. Well, then let's use that to our advantage and to the world's advantage by saying, okay, everybody in on this deal. All cost in, all subsidies out. Now make your own decisions. And that will spawn this free enterprise innovation that I'll be talking about in Rochester.
All right, well, I have to do this. I'm late for a break, and our guests have a lot to say on this. David in Pittsford, Tom in Brighton, Laura and Victor calling and writing in. We're going to get to your feedback as well, and we're going to try to cover a lot of ground in our last 25 minutes with Bob Inglis, former congressman and the executive director of RepublicEN, Peter Debs, vice chair of the Rochester Regional Group of the Sierra Club, Mark Cohen, chief of staff for the Greater Rochester Chamber of Commerce, Linda Isaacson-Fidelli from the Rochester People's Climate Coalition leadership team, Jose Fernandez, president of the University of Rochester College Republicans. Your feedback and a lot more from our panel next. Coming up in our second hour, my guest is John Steinman, the author of the new book, Grocery Story: The Promise of Food Co-ops in the Age of Grocery Giants. We're going to talk about why Steinman believes that big food is a problem, and there are alternatives and answers in the form of local and co-ops. He joins us next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. David in Pittsford on the phone first. Go ahead, David.
In terms of free enterprise, at the present time, the fossil fuels, oil in particular, is being subsidized by the law, the Revenue Act of 1913, and also has additional subsidies that have been applied since then, such as depletion allowances and so on. So maybe we ought to take a look at sunsetting some of the oil, the fossil fuel subsidies. Then the other thing is that at the present time, we're giving away the ability to dump pollutants into the atmosphere. And the carbon tax, of course, is an approach. So, I mean, there are two approaches here. One is to sunset the subsidies after 100 years or so. And the other is, of course, the carbon tax.
All right, David, thank you very much. Bob Inglis, I want to start with you there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think David's right. We should sunset those subsidies. There's no reason to prop up oil and gas, for sure. But we also should make it so that, in fact, at RepublicEan.org, we'd like to eliminate all the subsidies for all the fuels. That gets wind and solar nervous until they hear, including the biggest implicit subsidy, which is being able to dump into the trash dump of the sky without paying a tipping fee for the health and climate damages caused there by that dumping, that socializing of that soot. And so we think you should eliminate all those subsidies, especially that implicit subsidy. And the best way to do that, most efficient way to do that, is by a carbon tax.
And Bob, just to kind of as a refresher for the audience, can you give the short version of how the carbon tax would work?
Yeah, so at the mine and at the pipeline, a tax would be applied. Say it's $25 per ton. That would cause the price of gasoline to go up by 21 cents a gallon. It would cause the price of electricity to go up by $11 per month in the average home. And that would cause all kinds of changes downstream in our behavior. Since we're conservatives at RepublicEan.org, we think that we should pair that new tax with a cut in existing taxes or with a dividend of all that carbon tax revenue back, so there's no growth of government. And many progressives agree with that approach, which is very gratifying that we have that agreement. So there's no growth of government there. And then you would, second imperative, besides revenue neutrality, that's the dividending it back or tax cutting somewhere else. Second imperative for us at RepublicEan.org is that you apply it at the borders on imports from other countries that don't have the same price on carbon dioxide. And that's, as I was saying before the break, gets the whole world in on the action.
Linda, you like that one?
Yeah, I like it. Rochester People's Climate Coalition likes it very much. Although we have to say that as an organization that is very pro racial, social, and economic justice, we like the dividending it back part better.
Okay.
But we're just happy to have a point of common agreement to start talking about.
Sure. You want to add to that, Peter?
Yeah, I agree that one of the things Sierra Club has become very concerned about is the effect that this can have on people of very low income. So if their electrical bill goes up a significant amount, that can push some people over the border. So putting these things together so that they don't unfairly target certain groups is going to be another essential part of getting it passed without a lot of turmoil in the country.
Okay. Jose, what do you think?
A few points on the last comment. So there was a paper in the Journal of Health Economics that looked at the racial asthma gap, and it found that almost all of the gap was explained by higher levels of pollution exposure for minorities. We find that the minority school districts tend to be in more polluted areas. So pollution, not just carbon emissions, but lead and air pollution abatement, or lead and air pollution have significant costs and are fairly regressive. So on net, even before we consider how we're going to distribute the revenue, low-income Americans are going to benefit. But of course, we can improve that distributionally when we consider how we're going to distribute the revenues.
Okay, Mark?
I want to refer back to David's comment, which has to do with the free market. So in 1987, there was a report by the World Commission on Environment and Development, and they define sustainable development as development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. That is so critical, first of all, that it was established in 1987, and I'm sure people thought of it before then. But a society, you know, societies become wealthier, and we were talking about this during the break. As societies become wealthier, they tend to have better environmental policies. And the free market is responsible for wealth creation. It's also largely responsible for environmentally mature societies. And so countries with more of a command society, like China, would have demonstrably, they'd be worse off environmentally than free market countries like France and like Switzerland and the United States. And so recognizing, again, the economic opportunities for business and for these countries, for communities, when approaching things with an environmentally sustainable mindset and business practices, I think, again, demonstrably, this is not subjective. This is not political. This is, this is an objective fact. And I think David's point is well taken.
Before we get to Tom and Brighton, I want to read Laura's email because, Bob Inglis, when the last time you were on this program several years ago, if I'm remembering correctly, you had mentioned that in your private conversations with Republican lawmakers at pretty high levels, more often you were hearing at least a private concession that, okay, climate change is being driven by human activity. It is real. There's a political risk for me to kind of get on board with some of that, but maybe soon. And so what I want to do is I want to read Laura's email as a way of asking you how much you've seen change and how much you have not. Here's what she writes. She says, it seems to me that the public resistance to acknowledging human-caused climate change on the part of the present president and his allies stems from a greater allegiance to short-term profits of the extractive industries than to the common good, end quote. So that's Laura. And there's no doubt, Bob, that at the very least, we have a president who has 90-plus support among Republicans in this country, and he is sort of really kind of, according to scientists, dangerously and disastrously wrong on climate. I wonder how you view that in light of maybe some of the progress you have or haven't seen with other conservatives in the last several years.
Yeah, you know, I think Laura might be right that President Trump is focused on those profits of the extractive industries. I would guess, though, that he's more focused on it because of the cultural kind of connection that he wants to conjure up nostalgic images of America in the glory days of burning coal and making pollution and making stuff, not making pollution, but yeah, that was an impact of those
sure.
days, and so. We always tend to look backwards and think that, oh, those are wonderful days. Well, they were quite polluted days. There were days that, things were a lot better in a lot of ways. But there's been a lot of change. And for some people, that change causes us to want to go back to some nostalgic period, probably because our parents were in charge then, not us, and we were just enjoying childhood. But so now that we're adults, we got to rise to the occasion. And so I think that that's part of what Donald Trump's secret is. He knows he can rally a certain part of his base by constantly talking about those themes. That's what we at RepublicEN.org try to overcome, is help people say, no, these are the great new days ahead. Let's not look back to some halcyon days that never existed. Let's be part of bringing in these great new days of cleaner air and more sustainable operations.
Tom in Brighton wants to talk about what's going to happen in the next 10 to 11 years. And as I take his call, I'll also read Charlotte's email. She says, you know, are you misrepresenting Congressman Morelli on climate change? His comment was not that we can't change by 2030, technically, but that our politics is so jammed up that we are not likely to get there in time unless we can get Republicans on board. It's only true in part, Charlotte. I mean, he definitely thinks politics is jammed up. He thinks there's not political will to do this and that this would be too big of a lift to do this by 2030. But he also questioned whether the technology exists to do it as well. And that is something that a lot of the experts, and I am not an expert, I defer to the experts on this, tell us that if we have the will, the technology is there to do it. And that's an important component here. This is not a case of, can we invent a unicorn by 2030? Well, we don't have the will, but also unicorns aren't real. I mean, this is a case where I think if you can marshal the will, you can get there. But Tom in Brighton wants to add to that point. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I would like to address that. Basically, there's a somewhat naive attitude toward this. Listen, back in 1950, there was a project that was started called Project Sherwood, which was supposed to be control a technology to control thermonuclear fusion. And some people thought it would be just a few years before it would be successful. That was almost 70 years ago. We've had multiple programs since on that same effort to control fusion, and it still looks like it's like 40 years away. There are other technologies that hopefully would provide energy, but they're also very long-term. The idea that we could, you know, replace fossil fuels completely by 2030, which is like 11 years away, is beyond reality. And we just have to face up to it that if we're to achieve this goal of reducing carbon, and I agree with it, then we'll have to reduce our standard of living to a great extent. And that's the reality that we should be addressing, acknowledge, and we all have to share in that cost.
Tom, thank you. And I'm going to start with Bob on this, but I'd like everybody to respond. And Bob, you know, to Tom's point there about standard of living, I recently was talking with a friend who kind of works in some philosophy circles, and I thought it'd be an interesting program to talk to people in various sectors to ask, is it possible that we are living in the most sort of comfortable time in the history of human life, and that this will be viewed as sort of, you know, like when you drive in your car and your car says it's 68 degrees, but you really would like it to be 70. You know, you can just tick it up a couple of notches. I mean, it's an ultimate comfort that we have. And frankly, it's made people like me a little soft. But what Tom is suggesting, Bob, is that we may, if we can get there by 2030, it will come with an admission that we need to give up some of those comforts. Do you agree, Bob?
No, because I think that it overlooks the dynamism of technological change, like I was describing earlier in the case of the tech revolution. I think that it's what I'm expressing is a lot of faith in free enterprise, but I think it's a reasonable faith because of our experience in tech, for example. I don't think we have to look at a lower standard of living, particularly if we really open ourselves up to all the options that are available to us. And Tom's right about that fusion thing. You know, it was it's this thing that has been hoped for. I remember reading an article on like the fifth page of the Greenville News, a newspaper in the district that I represented, about cold fusion being successful. And I read it, and I was on the science committee, and I said to myself, why isn't this on the front page? For gosh sakes, if cold fusion has worked, it should be on the front page. It would change everything. It'd be like harnessing the power of the sun right here on Earth. You know, a hydrogen bomb explosion controlled. Sadly, in the weeks that followed, there was another article that said, well, it couldn't be replicated by other people. So Tom's right that fusion has been overstated. But there are people at MIT, for example, working right now on a very sophisticated way of controlling the reaction to hydrogen bomb, essentially, with magnets. If it were to work, it would change everything. Meanwhile, though, we've still got fission opportunities with small modular nukes. And I'm speaking from a state that just had a $9 billion hole in the ground that stopped on construction of a light water reactor, an enormous reactor that is now stopped. and we've lost $9 billion at least. But if we looked into small reactors, like the power of nuclear subs, and if we got broad agreement in our population that, hey, surely there's a waste problem, but otherwise we're going to pollute the air with coal, socializing the soot of coal. And so how about let's go with these small modular nukes? So there are things we can do and do relatively quickly and then hope that fusion or something like that comes long term.
All right, let me ask all of our guests around the table. Mark Cohen from the Chamber, what did you make of Thomas' comments there?
So from my understanding and you know, talking about carbon neutrality and again, from Rochester Chamber's perspective, how we can encourage businesses to do that, but just in general working toward carbon neutrality, that doesn't mean zero fossil fuels. That just means establishing renewable resources, enough renewable resources to offset the use of fossil fuels. So I don't think anyone is saying that by 2040, by 2027, you know, we're not going to use any oil, we're not going to use any natural gas, we're not going to use any of these sources. I think that would be great if we could figure out how to do that. But I think the point being is we've got to really speed up. And Linda and Peter were talking about, you know, the presence of the technology to make this happen. And by the way, opportunities for companies to develop additional technologies to make that happen. And I think that, you know, one, by setting that goal, we want to shoot for the stars. We want to make these things happen. We want to aspire for that sort of practice. But I don't think it's as pie in the sky as some folks try and make it. And, you know, what's frustrating from a perspective of, by the way, someone who identifies as a Democrat and who works for a conservative organization or what's perceived to be a conservative organization. But what's frustrating, again, is by making extreme statements, which, and I'm not saying that's what's happening. I'm saying just in general, in this dialogue, emotion tends, you know, to come out. And rather than making, you know, arguments from what Congressman Inglis does, which is make fact-based arguments, we go to one extreme or the other, which I think is unfair to the movement as a whole.
Okay, Jose?
So earlier Mark referred to the fact that freer economies have much better outcomes just in general, not just with economic growth, but also environmental performance. And so if you look at the Economic Freedom Index that's published by the Fraser Institute, you find that the freest economies emit far less carbon per dollar of GDP. And so there's a huge potential for greater gains. In fact, one of the best experiences I would refer to is the Clean Air Act in the United States. There was recently a paper in the American Economic Review, which is one of the best journals in econ, and it looked at air quality, which rose dramatically, and pollution for various different emittents, and that plummeted despite gigantic increases in manufacturing output, and they attributed that to the Clean Air Act's standards. So things like that saw dramatic welfare gains despite our great levels of wealth. Now there are opportunities to reduce a lot of waste, which we can do with a lot of behavioral economics nudges that I referred to earlier. But I really would push back against the idea that we would have to sacrifice our wealth in order to meet these IPCC targets.
All right, Linda, time a little tight. Go ahead.
So relative to Tom's point about needing to sacrifice comfort, I thought your example was wonderful, Evan, in terms of are we willing to sacrifice 2 degrees in the car? I mean, first of all, most people in the world don't live in that degree of comfort and do relatively fine. I personally would be willing to sacrifice 2 degrees in the car. But I think more to the point is that if we don't do anything, we're all looking at devastating changes in terms of our comfort and health because of climate change.
Okay, Peter.
Yes, I agree with that, and also that we're really talking multi-pronged that's going to be necessary to address climate change. And some very highly effective aspects of that would be increasing efficiency on things so that we get more for the buck on the energy, and we're very good at that. And another one would be conservation. Look at what we're consuming. How can we cut back on that? Do we really need all that stuff? Or can we recycle it? And then finally, the inexpensiveness in the long run of renewable energy.
If you want to attend on Wednesday, what do people need to do, Peter?
Please go to the Chamber of Commerce website and click on the button that's for events. Scroll until you see this event, which should be right at the top, and it'll give you a chance to register right there. We encourage you to make a $10 donation to support it, but if not, you come anyway, and we will enjoy seeing you there.
That's at the Riverside Convention Center Wednesday from 5 to 8 p.m., a free enterprise solution to climate change. Go ahead, Linda.
Just wanted to mention real quickly that at 5 o'clock, there will be a tabling fair with vendors there, and the keynote Address with Bob Inglis starts at 6.
And Bob, I'm going to close the program with a note from B on Twitter. She says, I couldn't imagine such a thing would be possible. I'm listening to WXXI News and Connections. Evan is interviewing Republicans, and I agree with much of what they're saying. My mind is blown. This is the kind of conversation we need to be able to have again. So 20 seconds, what would you say to B and everyone else whose mind is blown that they've been hearing Republicans like you and they can't believe they're agreeing with you, Bob Inglis?
Well, I think that climate change is a place where we could actually come together and model a way out of the morass we've gotten ourselves into.
That's a short and powerful point to close. And Bob, where can people find the work you do as executive director of Republic EN?
Go to republicen.org, and we'd love to see you there, republicen.org.
Bob, I always appreciate the time. Thank you. We'll see you in Rochester this week.
Looking forward to it.
That's former Congressman Bob Inglis, executive director of Republic EN. Mark Cohen from the Chamber, thank you.
Thank you.
Jose Fernandez from College Republicans at U of R, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Linda Isaacson Fidelity from RPCC, thank you.
Thanks a million.
And Peter Debs from the Rochester Regional Group of the Sierra Club. That's the official name.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
More connections coming up.